The Feel rises in the Mallacharach Mountains near Rockchapel in County Cork. It has always been a good trout and salmon river and has attracted anglers and fishermen from the surrounding counties. As well as that, it has been a good stamping ground for the poacher, especially the upper reaches of the river.
The general thing now is the salmon fly, sink a salmon fly and snatch the fish. You just get a bit of rotten thread and tie it onto the shank of the hook. Sink it down to the fish where you see him lying. Try and get it as near his side as you can and turn the line over his back and pull towards his head. You'll get a stitching in that way. Play him out then just as if you had him fair. Of course, you'll get a better play altogether because the fish has the use of his head and tail. Wherein, if you had him fair, you had him in the mouth. And he hadn't that much scope, you know, to get away. But you can be sure of a right fight with a fish when you have him hooked anywhere in the body, because he has the use of the head and tail, and he'll carry you all over that pool. He knows every rock that's in that place. He knows where he'll snag your line. He knows every bush, and you know from going in there from the sun. He can trip you up in 101 ways. You have to think like a fish to be able to kill him, get the better of him, and have good tackle and a good rod. You know, because you'll be surprised at the strength of a fish in the water when he's followed. Sometimes there's a little bit of a ripple in the water. More times the water is low, but you haven't any sun. So it is hard to see the fish. It is very hard to see salmon in water like that. But if you know what you're looking for, you look for the ring of his puss. There is a white half circle. And you'll see that. You mightn't see the salmon himself, but you'll see that half circle. And if you see that, you can be sure that's the salmon. And of course, you have the advantage of knowing where he might be lying in, where he's apt to be lying. And another thing was his back fin. It looked like a razor blade under the water. If you see that, you can be sure that's his back fin. And you'll sink the fly. Keep an eye on that. Put a bit of tinsel around the shank of the fly, or around the bit of lead, so as you'll see it going down. And you'll be able to guide it down inside him.
You were saying that it was even possible to snatch without seeing the fish at all.
Well, you can, but you have to know the bed of the river very well. You see, in high water, you're fishing fair maybe the whole day and you don't get a bite or a pull. There are days like that when fish don't take it all. And if you know the place, you could always try your luck by sinking the fly down beside these rocks where you know they're lying and taking a blind pull. Because if you know these rocks anyway fair, you'll know where the salmon is lying beside him. And 10 chances to 1, but you'll strike a fish if he's there.
There's a lot of poaching going on, and the fishermen must know what's going on. It's going on under their noses. And still they don't give us any information. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, they should stop it. And if there's a case, if there's a prosecution, they should volunteer to give evidence in court, but they don't even tell us until it's over. And then we're asked, why weren't you in such a place at such a time? And some fishermen who are depending on fishing for a living are allowing this to go on, and even some of them are even partaking in illegal poaching. When the fishing season is closed, they're taking salmon out of the river, spawning salmon, they're taking them out of the river. And we've tried to operate against that. And another thing we have is we've 24-hour duty. We're on duty. It can happen at any time of the day and the night, and we're stretched to the limit, and we just can't cope with it.
We had one trick that we used to use when we wouldn't know. We wouldn't be sure, you know, where the bailiff would be. We'd say to ourselves, well, he could be lying anywhere around here. So we'd walk along the bank and start looking very mysterious, looking in here and looking in there. If we saw fish, we wouldn't go near him, but we'd go to some place, we'd make sure there wasn't any fish, where there'd be a bit of a high bank or something like that, and we'd get down out of the view, you know, from everywhere around, and sit down, have a smoke. So if he was lying anywhere watching, he'd be sure that we were.
Oft times when I do slumber, I have a pleasant dream. I'm walking through old Dyer land, close by a purling stream. I'm roaming through old Dyer land with my true love by the hand. But away, quite broken hearted boys, upon Van Diemen's land.
I graduated to salmon poaching then, of course. Say, in the 50s, on the river field, salmon then were plentiful. Salmon run up about October. We'd go poaching this night. And I was distinctly going poaching with this bloke Bat, I'll call him Bat, and he was very good in the river. He had a great eye, you know, at night. He could find out someone to be in the river, and I could barely see him, and he could see him quite plain. That shine at night like a coin, that shine whitish at night in the water, that come out in the shallows. And we go along in the bank, one in each bank. We blacken our face in case we'd be caught. We wouldn't stand the course we were caught, we'd get away. We blacken the face and carry a black thorn. And Bat, he'd walk the middle of the river, up to his waist in the cold water, no trouble. And he'd see fish, he'd gaff him. And the gaff was barbless, there was no barbless. And he'd fishing, gaffing, I would land out to you then. You have to line the salmon, then you hit him. You get salmon 14, 15 pounds. Hit him in the head to kill him. And you'd have a spare gaff and give it a bat inside again. But he was marvellous. I've seen him now in freezing cold nights, up to his waist in the water, and we shivering in the bank, and he laughing away. I've seen him pick out 15, 16 salmon a night in 3 or 4 hours.
Well, the poaching this year was pretty bad, although we managed to keep down quite a lot of it. We confiscated an awful lot of gear this year, mostly at night time, upriver here from up around Ballyhorgan area and that, you know. And we also confiscated a lot of gear from the Gael, which is a tributary of the Feel, and cages and things like that from the Smearla and the Gael and the River Feel itself.
You should be a good fisherman to kill a fish foul. They beat a fish at his own game, because most fish that are in a pool, when the water gets low, you can be sure that they're in it for at least a week or 10 days anyway, and they know every inch of it. So when a fish has the use of his head and tail, he can give twice the fight. You see, he has the advantage of you, if anything, because he knows that thing can place upside down, and he'll make such a fight that you have to outthink him, and you have to think fast. Sometimes he'll take a run and he'll leave the hole completely. He'll make for another hole that he knows better, downriver. And you have to be fairly loose and active to follow him, because they can travel at great speed. They can nearly do 20 miles an hour in the water. But you have to travel at great speed after him. And no matter how fast you run, he'll still carry line, so you have to have your reel full of line. We used to never go out with anything less than 40 yards anyway of the best green hat rod and green flex line. I mean, for gaff, if you gaff a salmon now, or blast a salmon, or get them any other way, even in a net or a trap, you see, that you're giving no chance to fish that way. I'd prefer to have a foul play at a salmon any time to a fair play, because when you have a fish hooked in the mouth, he's half dead as it is. You know, he hasn't the use of his head, because you have the strain on him all the time. And you have him in a tender place. But he don't feel, when you have a stitch on his skin outside, he don't feel anything at all. Only that he's held, and he wants to go, and he'll try every trick he knows. He'll roll himself, he'll jump over the water, he'll do everything. And you have to be able to counteract his moves. That's what makes the foul player in a salmon so attractive.
The river winds a narrow way from Norcork to Abbeyfeel. After Abbeyfeel, it widens, and at this stall, the river is broad and deep.
On the riverbanks, wild duck, there are three species of the wild duck which were very common and are still to be found in lesser numbers. Mallard, widgeon, and teal. Now, the widgeon, and I think most of the teal, are almost entirely migratory. They come in here, with the flight in here with the October and November moons, and they stay with us until the end of March or end of April, when they fly out again. Now, a limited number of the mallard are breed locally, and they tend to be a slightly larger bird, though they're the same species. They tend to be a slightly larger bird than the one that flies in, if only because I take it the flight takes a good deal out of the flight from the Arctic regions to here takes a good deal out of the mallard.
And then the smaller birds, there are water hens and others.
Yes, the water hens, the common water hen, though they're not regarded as game birds, snipe and plover, both green plover and grey plover. Now, just coming out, while we were waiting for you at the bridge there, we, Doctor and I, saw quite a sizable flock of both green and grey plover. Now, these, the green are a protected species at the moment. The grey plover may be shot. And they do form a quarry for the sportsmen. No, not very. They're not very highly prized, but that's everything.
Well, as an angler, I see plenty of it. I've frequently seen the stoats. There are not many stoats in Isle left, but the South seems to have quite a good number. It's wonderful to see a stoat running along a riverbank. It's like a running flame, this undulating body of the little reddish, dark reddish animal going along, darting over branches and fallen trees, and you have to be quick to see it. And that's only one. There are all kinds of things, rats and rabbits when they were rabbits, and if you stay quiet, a hare, they're very inquisitive, the hares, and particularly around the South, they will come and look at you. They'll just sit down there, provided you don't move. The moment you even move your eyelids away, they're gone. Well, what others? Stray dogs? They're always there out in the hunt chasing rabbits.
Otters?
Well, otters, not so many. You have to be out very, very early in the morning or very late in the evening. But I have seen a family of otters, and there's nothing more wonderful in the world than to see an adult otter, probably a mother, you don't know the difference really, training the young ones. And they slide like children down a bank from the top to the bottom to the level of the water. And the mother is very playful with them. And of course, the children, if I can call them that, give her a terrific time. And they all seem to be there happy and contented.
And then the foxes?
The fox is a different sort of animal. He's cunning, and he has to be cunning nowadays. I regret to say that the hand of many, many men in this country is turned against the fox. I heard the other day a startling figure that 35,000 fox pelts have been exported from this country in 1979, and it looks like being worse in 1980 and 1981. I wouldn't like to dwell too much on that because it's a reflection on our own treatment of animals, the way that the foxes are being despoiled. I couldn't use another word, despoiled, in our own country. Now, coming into the winter months, there are vast, and I still say vast, numbers of wild duck. Some geese, not so many geese, the southern doesn't have them because the geese come from the Arctic Circle, but they do manage to get away down into Tralee Bay and therefore in the surrounding environment or habitat there. It's wonderful to see mallard flighting the moment that you go along the bank, as I do, an angler. There they're up in the sky and you can see a whole flight of them. And it's absolutely stimulating to stand there and to see these wonderful flocks. I say wild duck because it would be too tedious to go into all the different varieties that you have in that general ambit of wild duck. There are many very small birds, like robins and tomtits and thrushes and blackbirds, and you'd really, if you had a bird book with you, you'd give up all other things you were doing on the riverbank merely to study, and if you weren't a long time at bird watching, you'd have an absorbing interest there in writing down the species that you've seen or are seeing. It's a wonderful interest. It gives a whole new dimension to any person who is going along a river.
Tonight I see a cottage fire a-gleaming. The elves are dancing in the fairy ring, while up the stream come silver salmon teeming, alive with all the urgency of spring. And when the good Lord thinks it's time for homing, perhaps he lets my weary spirit steal to linger for a moment in the gloaming. Above thy banks, my silver river feel.
Listowel is the principal town on the Feel, and the anglers fish the river from Mount Collins to a few miles below the town. From there to the estuary It is fished by the netmen in their flat-bottom boats. The anglers of the Feel, like their counterparts on other rivers, have come to know intimately the pools and the haunts of salmon.
There are days you go out and any fish won't look at anything. There was only one cure for them then, if the day was really bad and they weren't taking flies or worms. If you could get a fresh prawn, and it seems that the salmon feed in the feeding grounds on pink prawn when they're developing in the sea. And when they see the pink prawn in the fresh water, they get awfully excited. And anything else won't go near this prawn. If anything touches the prawn, you can be sure to the salmon. A trout or anything else won't touch it. But it was Mickey Betty that showed me how to fish the prawn properly. And I think he showed Bob how to fish the prawn also, because you would lose quite a lot of them if you weren't used to the prawn. You see, the sink and draw method we used, because we had no spinning rods at that time. And it was 17-foot green hat rod, Castle Connell rods we used mostly have around here. There was a man in Castle Connell by the name of Winwright that used to make them. And they were a good rod for stormy day or any kind of a day. The only thing you could say against them was that they were very heavy in comparison to today's rods, the fiberglass. But the sink and draw method we used to use with the prawn, we'd sink the prawn and give it an odd jerk, you know, just as if to put a bit of life in it. And when the fish would see it, he'd leave where he was lying and he'd come to take the prawn. He might give it two or three pulls. Sometimes he would, sometimes he'd only grab it and turn around and go back to eat it where he lived, where he'd be lying, you see, in a certain place in the hole, and he'd go back to that place to eat the prawn. Well, it was when you should weigh it until he turned and be going back, actually, going away from him, before you'd hit him. Because we used to only fish the prawn with a big single hook. It would be fairly big, all right. But it was when the fish was going away from you, when he was travelling, you would hit him. If you try to hit him when he was pulling and choking with it, you know, you could pull it out of his mouth. That's why we used to lose such a lot of them, until we knew what he was to actually do with the prawn. We try that out even in poaching weather. We'd often drop the prawn in when we could see the fish and see how he acted, you know? And the fish, when he'd see the prawn, he used to tremble, you know? The tail would be shaking. And the next thing, he'd make a dry for it and he'd catch it. He might give it two or three tugs, but he'd always make back to where he was lying first before he'd swallow the prawn. And that was the time to hit him.
If you get a flood, a big flood, you get up the next morning about half-ish 5 or 6 o'clock, and you go where minnowing it is after a flood. You could start like at Fitz's Crossing, go on back to Bell's Bridge or back further, and you could spend the whole day, and you'd kill a lot of trouts. Sometimes it varies, and the trout seem to act funny as well. Sometimes you can kill 10 or 12 or maybe 15 of them. More times you can go back and you mightn't kill 4 of them, and they'd be there but they don't answer or something. Of course then about after dinner, when the flood is going down, you start fly fishing, which is, it's lovely when you get used to it. And you could kill more with the flies than you would with the minnow in the evening, like when the flood has gone down. But I come home to dinner, you know, if I was fishing for a day, I'd come home to dinner and spend an hour at home and go away again. It's a tiresome job, you know. You could really come home tired in the evening. And of course, but you still, you don't miss the time going. You never look at a watch or anything. It is a lovely, lovely day to be spend the day on the river.
Do you think some of the art has gone out now with the spinners?
Oh, sure, there is no art in fishing with a spinner. They're just slinging it. The reel does the whole thing for you. There is no art, really, in fishing with anything, only a fly. The worm and the prawn, there is a certain amount of art in them, but the fly is really the pure art of fishing. You've got to know where the fish lie and where you'll judge. If you're a fisherman, you'll always know part of the stream, or, you know, if the stream is going down beside the bush at the opposite side, you'll always know where the salmon is lying. You'll have a fair idea anyway, and you'll place your fly as natural as you can and bring it across as natural as you can with the rod, you know, the rod and line. There's a great art in fly fishing. But some lads are inclined to pull the fly, you know, against the water. And they make a curl in the water. Well, that isn't natural. Because if you watch the natural fly coming across the water, he'll never go up against a strong stream and make it, you know, cut the water. He'll go easy. If you meet a strong stream, let your fly rest and it tails over across into the shallow place, you know, which is like a dog swimming a hole. As a matter of fact, if you see a dog swimming a hole, when he goes in at one point, he goes in a kind of half circle with the water. He goes with the water and he comes out over the other side. He'll hardly raise a ripple. It's the same way, you know, throwing a fly in. You have to leave it come with the water. You don't have to. If you make any sudden movements and a fish is looking at that fly, he won't come near it. He won't touch it. You must make it as natural looking as you possibly can. That was the art of fly fishing. But with a 17-foot greenheart rod, I'm telling you, you had a bit of strength in that. When you saw the salmon come up, you watch your fly and you see the salmon come up. He take the fly and he goes down. You aren't supposed to put any strain on him now until he's going down. When you see his tail is the last part of him, you'll see you pull on him, fairly stiff pull on him, and keep that pull on him. Give him no slack. Let him travel. He'll carry a line, and he'll probably carry a line so fast that you'll have to run with him up or down the pool, whichever way he takes off for a start. But I often sweated a good bit playing a salmon. I'm telling you, if I met a wild one that would have space at you, you'd have to put your legs under it. He'd carry a line as fast as could be. And then you had to be fast to wind up again, because if he ran into you, he'd get a bit of slack and 10 chances to one where he'd go, you know. You had to keep a constant strain on him. Not too much or not too light. You had to keep a certain strain on him the whole time when you're playing him. And if a fish jumps over the water, you had to go up with him, raise your rod as he jumped, and go down with him again when he hit the water. Because if you didn't, when he'd hit the water, he'd break the hold. There's a knack in playing a fish when you have him hooked too, you know.
Tonight I see a cottage fire a-gleaming. The elves are dancing in the fairy ring, while up the stream come silver salmon teeming, alive with all the urgency of spring. And when the thinks it's time for homing. Perhaps he let my weary spirit steal to linger for a moment in the gloaming. Above thy banks, my silver river feel.
The ferry bridge crosses the river near the village of Ballyduff, and net fishing is carried on above and below this bridge. The name of the river changes 3 or 4 miles from the estuary, and the final stretch is known as the Cashin. Close to the mouth of the river is a small fishing village of the same name. This village, the Cashin, has always been the traditional home of the net fishermen. The boats used on the river are called ganlows, and some locals say that the name comes from the Venetian-type boats that the Fitzmaurices of Lixnaig Castle introduced on the river in the early part of the century.
Well, they're very inland, depending on the part of the river that you fish on. At the Cashin, they generally operate maybe 20, 22-foot boat, because some of those boats will at times go out what they call the long center, but up the river is generally 18-foot boat, flat bottom. And the most of the boats are made locally. And the general life of a boat would be 10 to 15 years, depending on the way you'd care it, and if you were fortunate enough to get a good man to make it. But nowadays, they seem, the life of them seem to be shorter, because the timber, of course, that is coming now is not as good as it was in other days. And as you know, these boats are out during the winter, where the fishermen have no place to stock them or anything like that, which helps in shortening the life of the boat.
Well, the boats are flat-bottomed and slightly curved, as well as being flat-bottomed. They aren't really what you call a flat-bottomed boat, because they're curved as well. And I'd say the reason for that is that they had a dual purpose on the river and outside the river on the strand, and where you had to have a shape, something on the lines of the... Is it a rake is the word, isn't it, on the curve on the boat? But even when you move up the river, as far as the ferry bridge now, in 3 or 4 miles, it loses a certain amount of the curve, because they're mainly fishing only on the calm, well, relatively calm river. But the boats of the Cashin did a lot of their fishing out the long strand.
Who makes the boats?
Well, generally there were the men within the fisheries that made the boats. There were a number of men, and most of them were very good at it. It was confined to about 4 or 5, and it was a trade in itself, and making a boat is not easy work, and local men made them. And as I said, they made a very good job of them. Where they learned that trade, it came down from generation to generation, and as the years went on, I think the boat making improved, even though that the material available disimproved. Well, as a rule, there were 4, possibly 5 men in a crew. And they have the net in the boat, and there were 1 man, shore the hall, as they call it. He will walk on the shore. Then there are 2 men pulling the oars, that's pulling the boat, moving it. And then there's another man drawing off the net. And then they will keep going while they have net, as a rule. And then they will, what they call it, come home in their hall, pull it in and save it. Sometimes they're lucky to fish, more times have nothing.
All life centres around the fishing, and of course it was only seasonal, and times weren't very good for most of the year. The winter was a tough time down there, but They were very industrious, great people. They were, you know, once Christmas came, there were thoughts of the fishing, and you'd see them, the men going back towards the mouth of the river, watching for the early signs of salmon coming up, and then the preparation for the fishing, which is ended now. That's the tarring of the nets and getting the boats ready. The tarring of the net was an event in itself. It was never done without celebration. There had to be that sent to the village for a keg of porter.
Last night as I lay dreaming, I dreamt of home again. Oh, why is all this dreaming to you I will explain. The reason for my dreaming to you I will confide. It's because my heart is broken since I left the Cashin side.
Maybe two or three families joined in the boat. Well, in a house where you had a big number of sons and men, they had a boat themselves, but you had two or three families maybe joined, very often related. They did intermarry a great deal in the locality and married young. And in that way, then, they were all very closely together and tightly knit. And celebrated, and at that time, before there was any such thing as a dole or any assistance of any kind, the fishing was the principal industry that they had. But there were industries in that they got, they took score of ground, as you call it, and they grew potatoes and caught turf and brought home turf. But a bad season meant a pretty bad winter. But the fishing was the
mainstay
and the principal event and the greatest source of interest, as I say, even though the fishing wouldn't open until the 1st of April. Once Christmas was passed, you were looking forward to the fishing, and they were able to get credit, I suppose, in advance in goods and so on the strength of the fishing coming at a later date.
Oh, there in dear old Ireland, it's happy we would be with our parents and our colleagues who loved us tenderly. At a hurling match or Kelly that we so well enjoyed, or at the feast of Christmas in the lovely Cashin side.
The river that began as a trickle in the Mullocharach Mountains is 100 yards wide and 12 feet deep at the Cashin. It has travelled about 50 miles and passed through three counties, Cork, Limerick and Kerry. Just below the Cashin village, the river disgorges into the Shan estuary between Loophead and Kerryhead, and is swallowed up in the waters of the broad Atlantic.
The Rivermen was presented and produced by Pat Feely and was first broadcast on RTE Radio 1 on March 13th, 1981.